everybody, and welcome to the Matthew Aaron Show. I am Matthew Aaron. I want to apologize for the show not being up at the right time. There was a technical problem with the show and with Blog Talk Radio. And personally, I rather put out a good show with no technical glitches for you at this point in time into our 260-some-odd episodes than to give you an episode that does not sound the best of its quality. So without further ado, here is tonight's Matthew Aaron Show with Jim O'Hare, Bill Holderman, Aaron Sims. Thank you. California. Part I do the Dre. Welcome everybody to the Matthew Aaron Show. I am Matthew Aaron. www.thematthewaronshow.com. You can catch us on Twitter at Matt Aaron Show. You can find us on Facebook. You go to the search bar. The Matthew Aaron Show is what you would type in. That's MATTHEWAARON. And you click like, and you will be sent everything that shimmy and shakes Matthew Aaron Show wise. Today, they'd kill me if I didn't tell you this. We can be found anywhere. Just Google the Matthew Aaron Show, okay? You can find us on Stitcher, iTunes, whatever. We are happening, okay? And the ratings have been great since we've been back. I want to thank everyone for listening to Dean Devlin and Trevor Moore last week. And tonight we have from Dance Baby Dance, Jim O'Hare, and he's got a new game show. About lullabies that you have to hear about. And, of course, you can see him in Landline. Landline, available VOD on Amazon Prime, on iTunes. I make no money off the Amazon Prime, but it's there for you. So give it a look. And then also Bill Holderman, the writer, director, producer of the book club, and Aaron Sims, the producer and writer of the book club, they will be joining us also as well tonight. Let's get to the show. So in order to decide whose interview I am going to do first, we're going to have to do heads and tails. Let me get a coin. Do I have a coin? Nope. Only the greens. So I am going to use a Taco Bell hot sauce packet. The phrase on this packet is, I won't tell. If it lands on the orange hot sauce side, we're going to go Jim O'Hare. And if it lands on the back, we're going to go Bill Holderman, Aaron Sims first. It is Jim O'Hare. Okay, well, hey, the hot sauce packets have it. Here is me and my good friend Jim O'Hare talking shop, kicking back, chopping it up. Enjoy, and I'll be back with you in a moment. Gentlemen, it's Matthew Aaron. I am here with Jim O'Hare. He's in the new movie Dance Baby Dance. Well, you got a million things always going on, Jim, and we'll get to them. First of all, I want to congratulate you on last year, Middleman, and I know we've talked about this a million times. And I was Lenny and I, we were lucky enough to see this premiere of Middleman. What a great movie. Great movie, great performance. So proud of you.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. It was, it's one of those, they say, passion projects, which I've learned that it's so different when something is your own passion project, because you're willing to go to lengths that you didn't think you would be. Yeah. To promote and to get the word out there. But the film did great. It ended up winning a bunch of awards. And, we always we always talk with each other, me and Ned Crowley, the director and writer, and we never even went into it ever thinking about awards or anything like that. Our goal was, let's just make a really good film. I had a personal goal of showing the world, you know, I'm more than just Jerry from Parks and Recreation, you know, playing the good, sweet little guy. And we did it. So on top of that, the fact that we won awards and have gotten a lot of, you know, accolades, and we had a theatrical run in 7 cities. Ran, you know, just for 2 weeks, but it was an exciting 2 weeks,
yeah.
You know, that we were in theaters. So, yeah, it was a gift, a real gift.
Yeah, and now you guys are on Netflix, you're on Amazon, you're on all those things, video on demand, iTunes, you're on everything, you right?
Find us anywhere, yes, yeah, we're all over the place now, which is great because even for me, you know, my agents can say if there's a let's say a client who's like, well, we don't know about Jim O'Hare for this kind of role when my agents are pitching me. They'll always say, check out this film.
Yeah.
And we've already gotten the response like, oh, okay, yeah, he can go there.
Yeah.
It's a very good thing.
Yeah. It was great to see that with you. You know, it's funny. I tell people, I've always known your work outside of Parks and Recs. It wasn't until I met you that I started watching Parks and Recs. So the performance in Middleman was a little less shocking for me, I guess, than for other people, because I always just thought you were a great actor. I didn't realize how typecasted you became from doing Parks and Recs. And by the way, great show, huge audience. Of course you're going to get typecasted, but I had no idea how badly that happens.
Yeah, it can get rough, you know. In Hollywood, you know, I love my career. I love being an actor, but you can get boxed. You know, you can get put in a box, and it can get tough to get out of that box. Thankfully, I had done a bunch of different stuff before Parks, and even more thankfully, I've been able to do a lot of different stuff since. So that's helped. It's really helped. But I'll never, you know, somebody said to me once, would you ever have any regrets? Like, you know, if you're just stuck as Jerry. And my answer is, it was the 7 greatest years of my professional life. So
yeah.
I could never have any regrets. And the friendships I've made, you know, we haven't been together in 2 years as a working cast, but we all had dinner together 2 weeks ago. I mean, we're still tight. These are lifelong people that I love, you know.
That's great. Yeah, no, and you guys are legitimately one of the shows that, like, the cast is all incredibly tight with each other. Do you feel like Middleman in any way led you to things like, I know you did Middleman around the same time or before you got Logan Lucky, but you know, that was different for you, and that was cool. You got to fire Channing Tatum.
Well, you know, Matt, I'm sorry, but to me, he's Chan.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying?
I remember the story you told me about that, where they wanted you to do the accent, and then you just had to throw it away at the last second. Soderbergh told
well,
you, what are you doing?
They built it up like I had to do this spot-on West Virginian accent, and, you know, I tell people, I am not Mr. Accent Guy, so, okay, I'll do what I can, and they sent me tapes, and then they had me working with, you know, an on-set, you know, I don't know what their term is, linguist or something, and the first day on set, I say that it was directed by Steven Soderbergh, which of course I was already nervous because he's the director, and then I say to him, listen, I'm going to do my best with this accent, and he, you know, excuse my language, can I swear on this podcast?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Okay, he literally said to me, oh, fuck that. So I was like, oh, and I realized he don't care. And it took so much pressure off of me. It was a huge relief.
Oh,
huge
yeah.
Huge relief.
Oh, I got to imagine, because I'm not an accent guy either. I have no interest in that. And no, it, you would probably
yeah,
the
well,
whole
so
time.
Some people can hear it. Yeah, some people can hear an accent and they can just do it. And there's some I can do, you know. I could do a little bit of an English if I had to. Sure, I could do a little bit of a brogue if I had to, but I can't maintain them, so they all turn out to be sounding very Mexican by the end of me doing it. So
yeah.
It's just never good.
So, like Middleman, what got you the role in Lucky Logan, you think?
It was an audition. Like everybody else, I went in and I auditioned. We got the call that I was going to go to the next level. And then the call came because I said, well, what is the next level meaning? Maybe auditioning for Soderbergh. You know, I didn't know what they meant by next level. And 2 weeks later, the next level was a booking. They just said, you're the guy.
That's great.
So I was thrilled. Yeah, I was thrilled. And of course, typical actor, I was sure that they made a mistake. I was flying there and had a full panic attack because we were shooting in Atlanta. And I'm like, oh, my God, I know he's made a terrible mistake and he doesn't know who he cast. So, you know, typical actor craziness.
I meant to tell you, by the way, we're here with Emmy Award-winning Jim O'Hare.
Yes, don't forget that, you son of a bitch.
Pardon me. I forgot, but Bold and the Beautiful, right? Is that what it was for, right?
I got guest, a lead, I have an Emmy for lead guest actor in a daytime drama.
Wow. Wow, congratulations.
Yeah, it was unexpected, yeah.
And now all the doors have opened up for you. Emmy Award winner.
Well, you know, I'm only 3 awards away from an EGOT. I need a Golden Globe, an Oscar, and a Tony, and I've got the EGOT.
I think you get the Tony for sure. You're doing all these plays every year. You're doing all these plays.
Well, I do want to do a theater. Yeah, I have the feeling of the other awards out there, the only slight chance I have would be a Tony. Movie-wise, I don't know that they're giving me an Oscar, and the Grammys, I don't have a clue. You know, that's all music sets that'll never happen.
But speaking of the plays, though, you got a pretty sweet gig going on. Is that Kansas? It's in Kansas, right?
Kansas City, Kansas, and it's a place called the New Theater, and it is this high-tech theater. They have 650 seats, and they sell out 8 shows a week. I've never seen anything like it.
Wow.
It's we do a Broadway schedule Tuesday through Sunday, 2 shows Wednesday, 2 shows Sunday. And again, I've never seen anything like it. And the accommodations are better than Broadway, because what people don't know about the Broadway theaters are they're very old. So you climb up flights of stairs to get to your tiny little dressing room. You know, even for the stars, because this is just how these theaters were made, you know, years ago.
Yeah.
And now this theater in Kansas City is super high tech. So I'm on the main floor. I got my big room. I got another room where they have me a couch and a chair and a refrigerator. And, you know, so, yeah, it's a really sweet gig. And also, as it turns out, which I didn't know this until the first time I went there, Kansas City is really awesome. It's a great place.
Yeah. And killer barbecue, we're told. But you know, I got to assume.
Oh, the barbecue.
Right? Okay, but I got to assume 8 shows a week, you're sold out. Everyone in Kansas has seen your show.
They bring people in from all over the place. I've never seen anything like it. Big buses show up. Those big trailway buses show up full of people. It's incredible. Again, I've never seen anything like it.
That's so awesome. We were talking about that. I'm just like, that's such a sweet gig, and you're like, yeah, it's they put you up and like the whole 9 yards. Good for you.
Dude, they give me a beautiful home and a car and the whole and not to get into any, you know, too personal, but the paycheck is better than Broadway. I mean, it really, the whole experience is pretty amazing.
That's great. You know, I was talking to someone the other day, too. I was talking about how you got to be one of the people I know who nobody works more than you do. You're about to go off to do, I mean, you have like 6-7 movies that come out a year. You're about to go off and do a movie. You were just telling me before we started recording, and I heard this maybe on your Facebook or something. I mean, you're doing a movie with Hemsworth, and you're doing a movie with Dakota Johnson and all them. What's this movie? How'd you get involved with it?
Well, in that one, the audition for it's called Purple Rose.
Okay.
And it was, I auditioned for it on my iPhone in Kansas City, you know, because the world is changing with how you can get yourself out there. And my agent called and said, we have this audition for you, you know, do it on your iPhone. And a week later, they called and said, You know, you got the gig, and then it was negotiated. But it's a big film. It's with, Jeff Bridges, Chris Hemsworth, John Hamm, Dakota Johnson, Jesus. And then, as it turns out, Nick Offerman is also in it.
Oh, my God.
Who is my buddy from Parks and Rec. Yeah, so that was just, you know, a crazy, weird coincidence. But, yeah, so I leave on Monday for Vancouver to shoot that there. So, yeah, I'm very blessed. The thing is, you say that I'm always working. It's because I love it. I truly, truly love it.
Yeah.
I am happier sitting on a set than I am sitting around my house watching television.
Yep.
It's just, for whatever reason, that's who I am. And my agents know it. Everyone knows it. Keep me busy. So that's, you know, that makes me happy. It's, you know, even Kansas City, it's gone for, you know, I had to leave L.A. for 3 months. That's my home. A long time, but with theater you have to make a big commitment, but yet every day I'm on stage, you know, and whether it's my ego or whatever, I do love it, and it keeps the juices flowing.
That's so awesome. You know what I've never asked you? I always wanted to ask you when we go to like lunch or something. I just never asked you. Didn't you work with
about 8.5 hours?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
What?
Oh,
I just assumed that's where you were going.
I mean, everyone assumes anyways from Parks and Recs, but
yes, of course.
I love the one line you give about that, where I think you said something to me once about it. I'm sure you use this all the time, where you said the writers were standing next to you at the urinal or something, and they just decided to write it in the show.
And somebody peeked over. Yeah, that's how it happened. Now, Matt, you're making it sound like I use the same material.
Oh,
I use one and done, my friend.
that's great. I was going to ask you, I never asked you, you got to work with Leslie Nielsen, didn't you?
I did. In 1996, I did a remake of Harvey,
right?
And,
yeah,
and it was with Swoozie Kurtz and Harry Anderson and Jessica Hecht and me and Leslie Nielsen. And wow. And, you know, I am a huge Airplane fan, of course, like everybody. And to me, I appreciate his career more for his comedy than his drama, though he did it all, which, of course, I respect, too, because, you know, he didn't get grounded where he could only be allowed to do one or the other. And so I was a big fan. But he walked around all day long with this little fart machine in his hand. And anytime anybody sat down or got up, all you heard, he was awesome.
Oh,
he was really
so cool.
Awesome.
Oh, that's so good. And, you know, he started out a dramatic actor. Like, nobody knew that Leslie Nielsen was funny. And then he turns out to be one of the funniest guys ever.
And he also said, I'll tell you this, I'll go ahead and say we were.
No, I'm just saying he turns out to be one of the funniest actors ever. It's just funny how that works out.
Oh, my God. But I love that got to get out. You know what I mean? Instead of just, you know, people let him do it. He showed that he can, and they let him do it. It's like with comedic actors, people think, well, they can't pull off the drama. But we're actors, ultimately. And I'm not saying everybody can do everything. There's certain roles I certainly can't do. But I know that I can do certain dramatic roles. I can do certain comedic roles. You know, we're actors. It's what we do. But also, I'll tell you, here's a little inside O.J. scoop. Because remember, he did Naked Gun with O.J.
Yeah, that's right.
And I said, you know, so we were shooting. This is after O.J.'s, after it was all, it was 96. So I think the murders were in 94.
Yeah.
So whatever. But we're sitting there one day having lunch, and of course we're trying to pick his brain. And the only thing I remember him saying is, I wasn't surprised. Now, I have no idea what that even means. Like, I kind of have created my own thought about what that means. But he said he was not surprised.
I mean, these guys spent you would say, about 3 years together. They did 3 or 4 movies together. That's a good amount of time. And they were studio films, so I got to imagine months and months they spent together. So for someone to spend months and months with someone and be like, I'm not surprised, it makes you kind of go, huh.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I've always, you know, felt the man killed her. So,
oh, yeah.
Whatever. But, yeah, I, you know, when you're around people, it's like, you know, people always like with the Parks cast, is Amy really as nice as she seems? I was with her for 7 years. I would have seen the cracks if they were there.
Sure.
There's no cracks. Yes, she's as nice as she seems. So my guess is over 3 years or however long they spent making movies, he might have saw a couple of things that he thought, oh boy, I could see him snapping.
What was it like, weird question, but speaking of the OJ thing, you were out in L.A. when this all went down. What was it like in L.A.? Did everyone just assume he did it in L.A.?
Yeah, it was very much like the, in my opinion, like, you know, the Trump victory. You just assumed it wouldn't happen. You know, you assumed OJ was going to be convicted, and you're just staring at the television like, are you effing kidding me?
Yeah.
What just happened here?
And I feel
I'm
like
to think the OJ trial was the same thing.
Right. I feel like in Los Angeles, there's like this bubble. And I don't mean this in a negative way. It's also a positive thing. But I feel like when we're in Los Angeles, we're like kind of, we get this gossip. We get the news before other people tend to when it comes to entertainment, anything. And I would just feel like everyone had to know OJ did it. Like, the gossip had to be huge in that town at the time. And
and you're right. Yeah. We are in a bubble, and I get that. And I realized it more after the Trump victory than I ever have realized it. That you're in a bubble of what you consider to be sane people making, you know, looking at things a certain way. And then you realize, wow, there's a lot of people who don't see it the way you do. And, you know, it's revealing, number one. It's eye-opening. And it's also frightening because I guess I've been very Pollyanna about racism and stuff like that. I mean, not that I thought it was gone, but it certainly, wow, it does exist big time.
18 million viewers.
That was tough to take.
18 million viewers for Roseanne, and everywhere I read, Deadline, Variety, The Wrap, they were all shocked, and I wasn't shocked. In the Midwest, we're not shocked that Roseanne did really well. And it was just another one of those things where I'm like, this is a very L.A. thing where they're like, oh, and now we got to go reboot all these other shows because Roseanne did well, and I don't think they understand why Roseanne did as well as it did. And
exactly, and they're going to pull all the shows out of the woodwork. It's like, come up with some new shit. Come on.
Yeah, I mean, what do you, as a sitcom guy, and I would assume Parks and Rec, that's not getting rebooted, but what do you think of all these reboots?
We've only been off the air for 2 years.
Right. Well, hey, I mean, they already rebooted Will and Grace. It feels like that just left the air yesterday.
Yeah.
What do you feel about
Will and Grace was off for a lot of years. It just seems like it was yesterday because they were in reruns so much.
Yeah, that's right. But what do you think of all these reboots?
They were off a lot of years.
As an actor, do you like all the reboots or you don't like the reboots?
Well, you know, I'm happy when actors are working. I think that's good. Like, but I come up with new shit. I just don't know why, you know, and I get what numbers are doing. If that's what's going to bring in numbers, that's all they care about.
Yeah.
So, but bring in new shit. If, why are we, you know, dredging the old shit? I don't know. I mean, I again, happy for actors that are working. Would never begrudge them that.
No.
I don't get it. I think it's lazy.
I think what they need to understand, too, is part of the reason Roseanne had the numbers it had is there's also an outcry in middle America for those TV shows of the past because they don't like the stuff that we've been putting out the last 10 or so years.
Yeah, that could absolutely be true. Yeah. But, you know, like Roseanne, for me, because I love that show.
Yeah, me too.
You know, she became so... so hard the last few seasons. Such a hard, kind of nasty lady that for me, it lost interest after that.
She still is.
And I haven't seen the reboot, so I don't know, you know, which way they're going with her now.
It's funny.
If there's an audience, God bless.
I thought the reboot was done really well. I just feel she still is kind of a nasty human being. And it's that weird dichotomy where it's like, well, I like Roman Polanski's movies, but I don't like Roman Polanski. I mean, are we allowed to like Roseanne's work, even though we don't like Roseanne? So, you know.
Right, I know what you're saying.
And that's one of those questions that's impossible.
I'm sorry. I was shocked that Goodman came back. I don't
know
why he did. He's got a huge movie career. That surprised me. And yet the ones who play the kids, they got to be so excited that they haven't worked in years. Yeah. And now, not only are they back, they're going to be on one of the big shows, and they're going to be back to making more money than they've ever made, which God bless.
Yeah, no.
Good for them.
You know what I want to ask you, because we lost a dog at the end of the year, and I know you went through this last year. And I told Liam I'd get him a new dog when I was in L.A., and I know you got Chase and Stella. And where'd you go? Did you do a rescue for them? I think you told me they were both rescues.
Yeah, both rescues. I got Chase from a place called Linda Blair World Heart Foundation. She's Linda Blair as in The Exorcist.
Yep, yep.
And she has a rescue. It's kind of far out, but she does, her whole world has become rescuing animals, and God bless her. And then the other place is the Amanda Foundation in Beverly Hills. And I got Stella from there, and she's the second dog I've gotten from there, and they're a wonderful place. I don't understand buying dogs when you can rescue it. It just, you know, to me, it doesn't make sense. So, please, you've got to get another one. I mean, I'm so sorry for the loss.
Yeah.
And it takes people whatever time it takes to get over it.
I think we're going to do it this summer, so I'll probably hit you up again to remind me where to go do it, where you think I should go do it, and then go get a rescue. That's the way to go.
Absolutely. I'd be thrilled to help you.
Well, thanks, Jim. And, I just want to thank you for calling in, and people can see Dance Baby Dance. What's the distribution on Dance Baby Dance? Where can people check that out?
You know what? I don't know. I'm not sure exactly about Dance Baby Dance, but I got to tell you, Stephen Colgan, he wrote this and directed it, and he, again, you want to talk about a passion project. He worked his ass off, and I'm telling you, because also, it's a dancing film. He dances on top of everything else. The guy dances in this thing. And it's such a sweet film. I don't know what the situation distribution-wise is.
Okay.
But if you're looking for just sit around and watch a film that is just kind of heartwarming, and there's no, you know, it's very, and again, you know, I love my blood and violence. But it's not that. It's a very sweet family film, totally a family film. There's nothing that would ever make you uncomfortable watching it with your kids. And I just think it's a great film to watch on a Friday. I wish I knew more. I'm going to check with Stephen about the distribution. I know eventually it'll be on all of the, you know, the places that you can get nowadays to watch stuff. But I don't know exactly where it is right now.
Okay. What I was going to tell you then is let's touch base then when I know you got this game show coming out this summer, and let's do a little PR for that at some point too. I'd love to catch up again before I come back to LA, and then we'll do dinner or whatever.
Well, like I told you earlier, unless I see you first.
That's right. That's right.
Hey,
well, thank you so much, Jim, for calling in and doing this. And of course, you can see Jim in our film, Landline, which is on Amazon
That's
Prime
right.
and VOD and iTunes and all that. And I'm always trying to put Jim in more of the stuff we're doing. So hopefully more of that.
Well, you know I'm a whore, so it always works.
Yeah, thank you so much, Jim. Thanks for calling
in. I'm a whore to work. Yes. Great to talk to you, Matt. I'll see you soon. And I'm so sorry about the puppy. Yeah. I hate to hear that, but you know what? Brighter days, you'll give another dog a wonderful home.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you. And we'll talk soon. Thanks, buddy.
Take care.
All right.
Okay.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was Jim O'Hare. You could catch him in the film Landline on VOD now. You can also see Dance Baby Dance on VOD now. We had a blast with Jim O'Hare on Landline, by the way. He was the nicest, funniest man you will ever work with in your life. Stuck around, took pictures with the crew every single day, autographs, whatever they wanted, whatever they needed. He'd have a beer with you. He was literally the best to be around. Did not act like a star at all. We had a great experience with him, Jimmy Dumont. Louis Lombardi was great with our crew. And, I especially loved Nick Searcy, of course. Him and I have a great time when we're together. By the way, played California Love at the beginning because the next 3 months we will be doing shows from Los Angeles as soon as Pat books them. Hopefully I'll be doing a lot of in-person live interviews for you guys, and I look forward to sharing those with you. So we will be back in L.A. People keep asking me when the live shows are going to come back. They're really hard to do at this point, and to be honest with you, unless there was the incentive of being paid and we've wanted to keep this thing free forever, it's really hard to get everyone in the same room who used to do the live shows, and it's really hard to produce those live shows. So we have this new format where it's me basically just interviewing the stars for you, and less me, more stars. And the ratings have been good. You guys seem to like the shows. I know you also like the old way that we did it, but, you know, thank you for giving this a shot. Up next is the my Avengers of the summer. It's Diane Keaton. It's Jane Fonda. It's Candace Bergen. It's Mary Steenburgen. It's Alicia Silverstone. It's Andy Garcia, Richard Dreyfuss, Craig T. Nelson, Don Johnson. It's The Book Club. And those are the stars, baby. Those were movies. So I sat down with Bill Holderman. I sat down with Aaron Sims. I think you will find this is one of the best interviews I've done. And here we are talking The Book Club with Bill Holderman and Aaron Sims.
He's excited to talk to you. He's from Chicago. I'm sure you already know that.
I know. I'm here with Aaron Sims and Bill Holderman. I'm kind of here with Bill Holderman. He's doing his coffee right now. But we're here to talk about The Book Club, which I'm super excited about. This movie is one of those movies that they would make, you know, I just talked to Dean Devlin about this, where they used to make these mid-range movies at the studios years ago that they just don't seem to make. And now you guys have to produce them and make them yourself like you guys did with The Walk in the Woods. And now you're doing it with your own movie, The Book Club here, with Diane Keaton and Candace Bergen and Jane Fonda, Mary Steenburgen, I'm trying to think. Andy Garcia's in it. Richard Dreyfuss, Craig T. Nelson. I can go on. Don Johnson. Hell of a cast. Great movie, guys.
Yeah, few up and comers.
Yeah, we're hoping we're going to break their careers with them.
But you know, isn't it
in a good way?
Isn't
not
it?
Break,
isn't
broke.
It crazy
no, like,
though?
Breakout stars. No one's ever heard of them.
Isn't it crazy, though, that you guys kind of have to do this the independent route nowadays? This is a movie they used to make in studio system. So tell us how this movie got made, because I don't think part of my audience is kids that are in college that want to do this for a living. God bless them. And I don't think they realize how this film got made. And I want you guys to explain it, because I think it's a pretty amazing story.
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, it started with, as all films do, with a script, and we came up with the idea back in 2012, right after the 50 Shades of Grey trilogy came out. And the cute little backstory of that is I was sending the trilogy to my mother for Mother's Day, and Aaron and I were, as any good son would do, and Aaron and I were working together at the time, and she thought that was absolutely ridiculous, and ridiculed me for about 5 minutes until I explained why I thought my mom might really like these books. And then she sent them to her mother and her stepmother as well. And so we started talking about our mothers and these.
As people do. Yeah. Talk about sex and their mothers.
Yeah. Sexy trilogy and our mothers. and then the next day, Aaron came in and was like, what if we did a movie about this? And so 30 seconds later, the laptop was open and we started writing.
The first rule of making movies is go on to GoDaddy and buy everywhere.
You're not wrong.
That was our excitement.
You're not wrong.
I'm kidding.
No, but in a weird way, on the last film I did, Landline, we had a competing film named Landline come out in the same year. And we were out, like, competing to get websites and Wikipedia pages and IMDBs. It's kind of a crazy thing nowadays, but that's kind of real.
Right.
So, yeah, so then, you know, what we did was, what you do is you go try to find money, because this is definitely not a movie that studios were interested in at that stage, at the script stage, and there's a lot of independent money out there available, and so we had a lot of interest, and we optioned it once and to a company that didn't do anything, and we got it back in 2016. And then we were back, the companies that were interested originally were still interested, and...
Well, I should jump in and note that when we got it back, we said, they still owed us some money, we said, do not pay us, just give it back, because it got stuck for 2 years, and that's something that happens in movies, you know, they option your script, and nothing happens, so getting it back was a pretty big coup for us.
Yeah, as much so as you said, forget
and
the money.
And we were willing to, you know, sort of buy it back out of that system. And then we had a couple companies that were interested, and... Truthfully, like, we'd go into a couple meetings, and there was a lot of pressure to cast the movie younger. We had written the movie for Diane Keaton and Jane Fonda and these actors of this age range, and there was a tremendous amount of pressure to, you know, cast younger. We had people saying, we'd love to finance this. We will, you know, we'll sign the deal today, but you've got to be willing to make it with 50-year-olds. And we just categorically said no. And
they were throwing out some pretty incredible names, actually.
Yeah,
and we were like, no, absolutely not.
But it just wasn't the movie we intended to make. And so having written it for Diane Keaton, we finally managed to get it to her agent and get her on board, and then get it to Diane herself and get her on board. And now with a script and the Diane Keaton attachment, it's a lot more fun to send it out to the other actors.
Sure.
And I will jump in to say, because I know what it's like to be starting out and trying to make a movie, you know, it's not quite as easy as Bill is making it sound, because Bill had a long history of producing movies, so he had a lot of great relationships at agencies, which is why you have to kind of start working in film at any stage that you can, so you meet people and you have that information and you can pick up the phone and they know who you are.
That's right.
That obviously helps with submitting your script to, let's say, Diane Keaton's agent. But again, that doesn't mean that she's going to say yes. But you've got that sort of history to at least open the door. So
yeah,
that's key.
No, that's huge. So when you guys get Diane Keaton, now obviously these are attachments. You haven't gone out and got the money yet. How do you sell, even though they're amazing actresses, and I'm sure Diane really got the ball rolling. We're doing something similar right now, and as soon as we cast one actress, they all want to start doing it. So how did you guys sell Diane, at least, on, hey, we may not pay you for this thing. We need your attachment. We need you to say you'll do the movie if we get the money.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of, at someone of that level, you have to have financiers ready. I mean, it's kind of a chicken versus egg a little bit, but you have to have financiers ready with their checkbooks if you get an attachment from, you know, if you get the certain actor. So for us, it was like, we had financiers sort of ready and teed up, and we just needed to get the cast that triggers it all. So we were already sort of on the in the position to pull that trigger as soon as we had Diane attached. And it was, you know, part of that game is you just have to convince the agents that it's real. And, you know, luckily
Which is hard.
Yes.
Yeah, it is. But you just, you know, you got to build trust with people and partly it's why relationships are so important in this business.
Well, but getting Diane before signing a deal with the financier is also a pretty good position to be in.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you guys get this amazing cast together, and if I'm, correct me if I'm wrong, but then you get the full financing for the movie. How'd you go about doing that?
Yeah, so once we had Diane and we were starting to fill out the rest of the cast, we had an equity financier in place. But the truth is, you know, as so often is the case when you're building independent movies, no one's willing to write a check for the entire amount of the movie. So you then have to go do foreign pre-sales to get the other sort of piece of the puzzle. And also in this case, to go after some tax incentives. We were lucky enough to get the California tax incentive and be supported by the California Tax Commission or Film Commission. And then we had at the point that we were doing foreign pre-sales at Cannes last year, we had Diane, Candace, and Jane, and we're talking about, Mary for the Carol role. We didn't have her attached yet, but, and so then you do foreign pre-sales to try to bridge that little bit of extra money that you need to just start pre-production.
But because of the age range, I think they still made it difficult for us because they were selling but saying, oh, but you don't have any of the men attached yet. And it was like, well, but we've got Jane Fonda, Diane Keaton, Candice Bergen. That kind of surprised me.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm enjoying this ride now that people are sort of realizing what we knew, which is we had this great thing. You didn't need any more extra protection, you know?
That said, the one thing that was a challenge too, was I was a first time filmmaker. I was a first time director, not
sure.
A first time filmmaker, but a first time director. And I think for foreign companies, foreign distributors to not have someone sort of leading this thing with
a track record
was pretty challenging. Cause again, they're signing a check based on not seeing anything but a script and cast.
Yeah. That was challenging on every level, in terms of, I think, the financiers were only willing to go so far, or we have to convince the actors one by one to take a chance. And when you have a first-time filmmaker, you're certainly making things more difficult for yourself, but it's worth it in the end,
I find this interesting.
Yeah, there's a lot of those one-on-one meetings with the actors where you have to sit down and convince them that you're up to this. And that was,
And financiers probably would have laid out a lot more money if it was a known quantity. But what's ironic is with a known quantity, you can't get something, completely new, like with a new filmmaker.
Yeah.
It's a weird situation.
Well,
but I get it. It's riskier with a first
one. Yeah, but you guys did something excellent here, which is you hired Andrew Dunn, who's an amazing director of photography. Actually, I spoke to Andrew just privately about something else like a month ago, and he's one of the most gracious, kind human beings you'll ever meet in your life. And he's just so nice to me. He has no business being nice to me. He's so nice to me. And he's such a talented DP. So, Bill, you kind of have, you're the new guy on the block. You're the new kid on the block, but you have a lot of producing under your belt. And then you have a guy like Andrew Dunn at your right hand. So that had to kind of ease people a little bit.
Yep.
At what point did Andrew get involved?
Andrew got involved after we were fully financed and fully cast. But that said, Andrew was the greatest gift to the film.
We didn't have Mary when Andrew came on.
You didn't?
Yeah. No, we didn't.
Oh, well, we were fully financed and we were going into pre-production.
Yeah. We were going into production.
So what did you say to yourself?
Andrew Dunn is truly like a gift to the world. And, what was interesting is he's in, he's UK based. And so Andrew and I we sent him the script. He was the first person on our list. And so we sent him the script, and the fact that he responded to it, we were like kind of,
freaking out.
Yeah, didn't know what to do with ourselves. So I set a Skype meeting with him, and we set aside 30 minutes to chat with him. And literally the Skype meeting went on for 90 minutes. And at the end of it, I sent an email to everyone on the producing side and financing side saying, this is the guy, like hire him immediately. And then the next day I woke up and I was like, oh my gosh, I just like the cardinal rule of make sure as a first time filmmaker that you do your due diligence and you do, you meet a lot of people. I just abandoned that rule. But Andrew, in that meeting, there was such a connection, and he is, as you said, like he is just the kindest sort of and such a brilliant artist.
Yeah.
It was really a blessing for the film.
And because of Andrew, he attracted an incredible crew because people wanted to work with him.
Right.
And then the other piece that we didn't realize was going to happen is because we were shooting in L.A., so many crew members were so excited to be at home in Los Angeles with their families. So our crew was insane. We had like the top, top level people working on our movie and working for less than obviously what they're accustomed to making. So it was just one of those, like, we didn't plan this, but it turned out.
Just a tip for those listening, they're talking about the book club right now, and book club was in LA, shot in LA, and they were able to get a crew at a rate. They were able to get, like, you know, a lot of people want to work from home, and we're shooting our next film from San Diego, and that was super attractive for everyone because it was 2 hours from LA. And it's a real thing.
Yeah.
It's a real thing. If you want to get the pros, it doesn't hurt to shoot in their backyard. So you guys have this history together. I want to get back to the beginning of Aaron and Bill, if you will, where you both worked at Robert Redford's production company, still do, I'm assuming. Or do you not?
No, we don't.
Okay, you've branched off.
I left in 2014.
Okay. Oh, wow. Okay.
And I left in
Okay, so what have you guys been doing? First of all, I want everyone to know that you guys were there for, like, All Is Lost and A Walk in the Woods, or at least in the production of A Walk in the Woods. And you've done these really great movies with a cinema legend. What did you guys do when you left? Like, what's it been like since leaving there? What's been going on other than book club?
Well, I left in 2014, but I was the lead producer of Walk in the Woods, and I'd written the script,
yeah.
So stayed very connected to that through post-production.
Which, by the way, I wanted to tell
you,
sorry, Bill, I didn't mean to interrupt. I wanted to tell you, I love A Walk in the Woods. I thought you did a great job with that.
Hey.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
That was a fun one.
It was. And so after that, you know, it's, again, as a screenwriter and an independent producer, I was out doing what you do, which is I was writing, trying to get Book Club made. We optioned it in 2014 originally, and then I was producing some other sort of independent projects.
He made a movie actually in Chicago called What They Had. He produced it with Hilary Swank and
Michael Shannon.
Oh, my God.
Blythe Danner and Robert Forster was the first time filmmaker Elizabeth Chomko, and it actually comes out in October.
Yeah.
And then I produced another movie called Old Man and the Gun with Redford and Casey Affleck, David Lowery writing and directing, and that comes out also in October. So
that's so great.
2018 is a big year.
Bill was with Redford a long time. I was there for about 5 years, and so Bill left in 2014 and was out producing and also, like, you know, working to get Book Club made. And I was with Redford, and, you know, we're working on various things, but we went and produced a movie called Our Souls at Night for Netflix with Jane Fonda, which is how I knew Jane Fonda. And in 2016, we got a bite on Book Club, and we had to go rewrite the script. So Bill and I spent a year, once I left Wildwood, we literally wrote for a year. I mean, I think that's what we were doing all day, every day, because there was a, you know, we had to overhaul the script from its original, like, pre the movies existing and all that stuff, because it had been stuck for a little while.
And we were really, you know, one of the things that, again, if any of your listeners are writers, you know, one the most important thing, and you hear it a lot, is, you know, there's writing and then there's rewriting. And for me, I actually cut my teeth rewriting scripts first, and so it's such an important part of the process. But one of the things that's so important is knowing, once you know who your actors are, if you can custom tailor it to their voice, and really sort of fine tune the scripts, you're in such a better position when you either present it to them or when you actually get into production. So that rewriting process that Aaron's talking about was, you know, arguably the most essential component to this whole development of Book Club.
I think you're rewriting probably. Were you rewriting, like, even into filming? Like, sometimes I just feel like you're always rewriting.
You know, the thing is, when you're making a movie, you're always throwing curveballs, and if you have that sort of tool in your toolbox to write your way out of it, there's a lot of times where, whether it's a location change or something shifts, or there's some other sort of production exigency that you can solve through writing, you end up rewriting the
whole
time. Or an actor on the day is like, hey, I'd really prefer something, a different line here. So you have to be sort of nimble and ready to pitch on the spot.
And having been, you know, once we went into production, I really was not, you know, the writing, I was just focused on producing the movie, but I have to tell you, watching from the sidelines with Bill directing and producing and having to do rewrites all during prep and sometimes a little bit in production. That was not for the faint of heart. I mean,
no.
There was, you know, emergency situations where he had to write us a way out of it, and I still can't believe that he pulled that off because the pressure was so high, our schedule was so tight. There was so much going on. It was out of control.
I feel like I'm going to have to pay her for that. But,
no, seriously.
But it is. I mean, you do have to write, you know, to stay in your budget. You have to, I mean, again, it's like the part of making a movie independently is trying to get ahead of the fire and put it out. And sometimes you put it out with your pen.
I mean, we had days where we were shooting, you know, whatever, a huge day. And then he'd have to get on calls at the end and then come home and do a rewrite till 2 a.m. and then wake up for a fight, you know, for call time. I mean, it was really pretty intense.
Yeah, that is making a independent movie nowadays, isn't it? You got like 20
yeah.
some days to shoot, and you're literally, there's no sleep. Sleep doesn't exist. I got a curious question for you guys, because Aaron, you started out as an actress, and Bill, you talked about how you had like your hands basically all over the place doing producing and working with Redford's company. So what made you guys decide to write this together? And was this the first project you wrote mm-hmm. together? And if it was, what was the rhythm like in doing the work?
Well, so I was doing development at Wildwood, so obviously deep reading books and articles and, you know, working on stories and talking to Bill about it. But when A Walk in the Woods was back in the mix, Bill needed to do a rewrite in order to get the green light. And we pretty much sat side by side. He was certainly writing, not taking any credit there, but we had a great back and forth conversation about what do the scenes need? We did a lot of talking and analyzing of every scene and analyzing the whole story. And we realized that it wasn't just, you know, development girl and producer talking about ideas. It was like we had a very good script sense together, story sense. And we did not plan to write a script. I had never written one, so certainly was not something on my mind. But when we came up with Book Club, it was one of those things. You just know we're doing this. Don't know why, can't explain it. But we were just super motivated and excited by the idea and loved talking story together.
What was that work process
for me,
like?
You know,
oh, yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, Bill.
Well, no, I was just gonna add, you know, for me it was at the company, and again, Robert Redford's a legend and a tremendous sort of star and all of that, but it's hard to get movies made for that demographic. So oftentimes I would just sort of do script work to get them over the hump, whether you run out of development money or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's what happened on Walk in the Woods. And so writing was always a way for me to make movies. Like, I wanted to make movies and I saw a path, through writing. But so that was part of it. And when this idea came up, it seemed like such a sort of natural and sort of fun movie to write. And I really wanted to do a comedy. So there was no hesitation in terms of that. But to answer your question about the actual work flow between Aaron and I think, you know, it's odd. I think every writing team has a different system. We literally will sit down at one computer, and it's like, there are times where it's like four hands on the keys and, like, you know, I'll slide it to her for a line and it'll slide back to me for a line. I mean, I would not say it's common, but
he'll be typing on the computer and I know what he's about to type. It's like one of those.
Yeah.
And then I'll just be annoying him saying stuff to the screen.
And then we will go off on our own and do sort of sections or passes or want to present ideas. But there is, you know, from a story development standpoint, it was really, you know, it was fun to just have someone to talk who had such great story instincts. And I think you talked about Aaron starting as an actor, and even though that is not the pursuit currently for her, I think that rhythm and understanding rhythm of dialogue, I do not know anyone in the business, and I've been in this business for a very long time, I do not know anyone in the business that has a better sense of dialogue rhythm. And it's something that is like such an unheralded part of screenwriting. And, you know, a screenplay is only a template to make the movie, but that screenplay is the tool that gets people interested And if it's readable and has the right sort of rhythm and pace, you are so much better off.
Oh, so much better off.
And I think that was, we really had, you know.
I definitely, dialogue for me is like musical. So that's kind of how it comes into my head. So I can feel when it's a little bit off. But I will say in the later phases, though, Bill is a very strong writer. I do not claim to be as strong a writer as he is. So I really moved into more of a story editing thing in the later phases. He'd go off and rewrite something, and I would, you know, break his heart by saying, no, this isn't it, or, you know, tell him it was incredible. So the final phases were really hard because I had to sometimes be like...
There's nothing worse than spending, you know, 12 hours at a coffee shop and coming home with, like, 15 pages and saying, hey, what do you think, and being told,
no.
Burn them.
Tomorrow's another day.
Burn them. So for you guys, what was the best part and the worst part of doing an independent production? I know, Bill, now you've done quite a few of them, so maybe it's like, and same with you, Aaron, but it's like an overall, like, we're making independent films. What is the best thing about it, and what is the worst thing about it?
You know, everyone's different. I think the best thing about it is if you, and this one we had the benefit of hiring the crew from the ground up. So, you know, Andrew Dunn, as an example, like we really surrounded ourselves with people that that we not only liked, but were sort of inspired by. And I think the best thing about making an independent movie is when you get to have those collaborators that you genuinely respect as artists, but also just really like as people, and you are all pulling the wagon in the same direction. There's a real bond that's created, and it's a real sort of, it's just a really fun experience and really enriching, and that is always great. And we also got to work with some of our closest friends. Our production designer, Rachel O'Toole, is one of Aaron's best friends. Our set decorator, Josh Inch, is one of my best friends. So it's like we had a really special opportunity to sort of work with people that we really just love.
And I will say, coming from, you know, producing movies, the best part for me in this case was that all of our ideas, it was all on us, and we got to actually try and sometimes succeed and sometimes fail to do exactly what we wanted to do, which was very cool. There was no other real checks and balances in terms of like some other producer saying no. We were supported to do what we wanted to do creatively. And I would say the worst part was having these legends in your movie and not having enough time sometimes to like do another take try it a different way. That was slightly heartbreaking because I just felt like we had such an incredible opportunity. So I think as a producer, there was sometimes where we were moving on and I was like, oh my God, but doesn't everybody see that we have these people? We should just take a few more minutes. But it's like, no, this is independent film. You have to move on. And you have to get your day. So that was,
yeah, I would say budget and time is always the most challenging thing of independent films. And, you know, it's the battle between the business side and, you know, people looking at spreadsheets, and then the creative side where you're actually making the movie. Well, and
it was like The Amazing Race. So it was, every day was super exciting and challenging.
Well, the creative freedom, I think, is the best. And the worst for me is, and it's kind of what you guys are saying, but the thing that keeps me up at night and, like, bothers me and I gossip about with everybody is I wish I could pay people what they're worth. Like, it sucks. Oh. It sucks that you have to ask people to come do a project with you, and here's what we're going to pay you, and it's laughable.
Right. Yeah.
That's the hardest for me. For me,
there's a lot of like, hey, we'll try to get you on the next one, but we all know an independent film, that is part of the challenge, certainly, and it sucks.
I got some questions that are coming in. First of all, Bill, was the intention for you to always direct the movie? I know we talked about this a little earlier. It sounded like it. I guess it just wasn't clear enough. Was it always for you to direct the movie, or was it just because of the budget that you're like, hey, I can direct this thing. It'll save us a couple hundred grand or whatever.
No, I mean, I think what happened originally, we wrote it as a movie for us to just go produce. And then after we got the movie back, after the option expired in 2016, at that point, I was in a different place career-wise, and when we dove back into the script, I just, you know, the themes of the movie, the everything about it, even though it's sort of, the actors are a certain age, and it may feel like it's not a movie that would have a real strong personal connection, for me, it really does, and I really, I got to a place where I just didn't want anyone else to do it.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, we early on had some directors interested, and then when we sold it, we were obviously going to go out to directors. And the fact that our movie was held for 2 years at this company, I think for me, and I'm pretty sure Bill, when we got it back in 2016, we were just tired of other people,
yep,
you know, having control over this project. And I said to him, you know, like, why don't we just, we think we know what this is, we think we know what it should be, why don't we just put our money where our mouth is? If we screw it up, at least we can just blame ourselves. I was tired of being on set and, like, wanting to accomplish things, but I'm not the director, so therefore I can't actually execute on my idea. And I think Bill felt the same way. And, you know, so we just decided, let's just go for it. Let's not let somebody else's sort of perspective come into this project. Let's try to just do it ourselves.
That's the best way to do it. Get you guys behind the camera. Okay, another question that we have is if Robert Redford has offered you any advice before you directed this film, Bill, because, of course, he's a legendary director as well, or if there was any advice, period, given by someone like Robert Redford, could it be even in the past that he's given you advice that really shaped the way you could have made this movie?
Well, I think, you know, one of the great benefits I had in terms of being his producing partner for as long as I was and working so closely with him on movies that he was directing and movies where he would be a director and the star. And, you know, I, as a producer, I was a very, very sort of hands-on producer. So just gleaning that experience from being close to it was incredibly helpful.
Yeah.
But there wasn't any specific, you know, piece of advice that sort of changed everything. I did talk to a couple other directors before getting into this position. I talked to a couple friends who were directors and sort of asked their advice and really asked for what, like, the pitfalls were. Like, where do I go? How do I avoid, like, the obvious mistakes? And one of those directors who does a lot of comedies gave me a lot of great advice about how to communicate with actors when you're not getting what you want. And I think it was really helpful because he would say, you don't have to give them the perfect note, but you do have to give them a note that makes you guys keep trying different things. And it was really one of those things that's incredibly helpful. The great benefit here is I had actors who were such great comedians, such great actors, that, you know, they bring so much on each take. But it's very comforting to have, you know, friends who are directors give you advice throughout the process just so you feel like this high-wire act, you're not alone up there.
I also think that, you know, we were lucky because when you work with Redford, you're meeting a lot of big actors. You're on set you're dealing at the highest level. And so I personally, if I had ended up on the set of Book Club without having been with Redford for 5 years, like, I'm sure I would have been way more intimidated than I was. So
yeah,
it was good to have those prep years of sort of getting used to being in that scenario.
And you get desensitized to movie stars, and it becomes it becomes about the work, you know, it really does, and they become your collaborators, and it becomes a much more sort of healthy professional dynamic, which for us on this was really important.
See, I could tell Erin's not desensitized because when she was talking about knowing Jane Fonda, she was doing it with that way where she's like, I know Jane Fonda. She's very excited
exactly.
About knowing Jane Fonda. So I wanted to
anyone
ask,
really know Jane
Fonda? I gotta tell you, I want to
we love Jane so much, you have no idea. She is absolute sort of icon, legend, and she's one of the just greatest humans, too.
What I was going to say about these amazing women is Diane, Jane, and Candace Bergen maybe have the best Instagram accounts on the planet. These are three women.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
That are in their like mid-60s, early 70s, that like know how to use Instagram better than I do. Candace Bergen's maybe the funniest person on the internet ever. Ever. Like she it's like
literally,
hands down. Yeah. Hands down, she wins. And Diane's Instagram account's
and
so artistic and wonderful. I mean, they're great.
I know, and I feel like if she just made her name Candace Bergen, the rest of the world would know, but she's Bergen Bags.
Yeah, right.
She paints these incredible bags, and which makes it all even, you know, I don't know, just makes it even more amazing. But she is so funny.
Oh,
it's
my God.
Crazy, and she's like that in real life. She'll just walk by you and throw out a line, and you're like, oh, Candace Bergen, you're a genius.
My goal is to have any one of them teach me how to use Instagram. That
yeah.
Is-
Yeah,
it didn't happen during production, but maybe now.
Phil is very sad on social media.
Maybe now on the, you know, on the press circuit, they'll teach me.
Somebody actually like yelled at him on Twitter because they wrote him like, "Why don't you tweet more?" He's just not into it.
Yeah, I'm not into it either. Like Pat does all my tweeting for me for the most part. I just don't even know how to do it, and I'm 34. Like, I should know. Like, this is something I guess I should know, you know? So, Bill, I was going to ask you.
You're an old soul.
Yeah, I'm very old. I'm Bill.
You got to find one of these 70-year-olds that really know how to do it.
I know. I need Candace Bergen to teach me how to use the internet. you have What They Had coming out. It's a Chicago film. As a Chicago filmmaker, I want to thank you for shooting here, first of all. But second of all, what was it like for you to come do a film back to where you're from?
I'll tell you, I love that city so much.
Yeah.
It was really, I hadn't been there for a long time, and it obviously evolved. I visit family every year, but to be there for several months was really a special experience, and it was fun. I mean, Chicago, you know, it's one of those places there's so much soul to that city, and there's so much, and you feel it with the people. And it was, I could go on about how much I love that city. It was really great.
Yeah. When did you leave the city? Like, what's your career stats in the city, if you will? When were you here from?
I was born and raised there. I went to college north of the city at Northwestern, and right after graduation left. So I've been gone for 19 years.
Yeah, but you were there a good chunk of time. I lived in Evanston, and that's a beautiful area. And, oh, wow, that's great, man. I'm so happy you came back and did something here. That's great. Aaron, I hope you come make a movie in Chicago. That'd be great for me.
Oh, I come there all the time. I'm a big fan. I really do. I love it there.
We would love nothing more than to come to Chicago and shoot a movie. I think it's such a photogenic city too, and there's so much history and architecture, and it's the people. It's one of those places that you know, I feel really blessed to have been raised there, and I feel blessed to be able to go back there and visit family and visit the city because it's a special place.
We were developing a project that's set in Chicago because Bill grew up, I think his window looked at the Drake.
Yeah, the Drake was my nightlight.
And this book, everything takes place on that in that area and in that neighborhood. So we'll see. Maybe we'll be making a movie there.
That's great. I just want to thank you guys so much for doing the show here. And the book club's coming into theaters, and I'm taking my mother. I'm sure it'll be an awkward experience. And It looks great.
You guys will love it.
Tell everyone, please.
Take your mother and all her friends.
I promise you. It's all I've been talking about on Facebook. Does Diane need a premiere date? This is all I've been talking about. This is literally my Avengers. You've brought together my superheroes and made a movie. So we're in good shape here. I'm so excited about this.
Oh, great.
Well, fabulous.
We feel you.
Yeah, I'm so happy. Thank you guys so much for doing this and coming on and talking to me. It was a real pleasure.
Pleasure was ours, and when we get back to Chicago, we'll track you down, or if you're out here, let us know. We'd love to.
Please do. I'll be making movies. Thank you.
Oh, good.
Beautiful.
Thank you, guys. Thank you so much. Have a good day, okay?
Thanks, you too. Take care. Bye.
Bye. thank you to Bill Holderman and Aaron Sims for that great interview about the book club, which you can see in theaters Friday. I want to tell people, not to pat ourselves on the back too much here, but outside of when I sat down with like Billy Friedkin or something, that's one of the best how to get this movie made interviews I think we've ever done. I just think one of the best interviews I've ever done, period. I really enjoyed talking with them. Yeah, I just think they're fantastic. And I hope the book club's a huge hit. I think it's going to make like $100 million. I think there's a huge market for that. And I hope that the audience for that comes out in spades. I really want to thank our guests today, Jim O'Hare, Aaron Sims, Bill Holderman. I want to thank you guys for tuning in. And we'll be back in the coming weeks with shows from Los Angeles. And I think we're going to have some really interesting guests. I'm going to try to sit down with everyone and anyone. So let's do this thing, and let's make the next 3 months awesome. Thank you for tuning into the Matthew Aaron Show. Go see the book club that's in theaters Friday. Dance Baby Dance on demand now. And, of course, Landline, Amazon Prime, iTunes on demand. Make me some money, baby. Thank you very much, and we will talk in the near future. The Matthew Aaron Show, signing off.